Welcome to this episode of Anesthesia on Air, the podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. This is the second of a two-part series where we're discussing shared decision-making. My name is Stuart, I'm an anaesthetic registrar based in London, and I'm joined by Sam.
My name's Sam, and I'm an anaesthetic registrar based in Manchester. Again, we're joined by Lila, Sam and Gemma.
I'm Lila Finikaridis and I used to work at the Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication. And most recently, I've been writing some decision aids for NHS England and rewriting some risk leaflets for the RCOA.
My name is Sam Finnegan. I'm a GP in Sutton Coalfield for half the week. And I'm also an academic at the University of Birmingham. I'm interested in personalised care and shared decision making, and previously I was part of the NHS England personalised care group as a national clinical specialty advisor.
So I'm Gemma Hughes and I'm Associate Professor of Healthcare Management now at the University of Leicester Business School. And I have been working with the OSIRIS team. That programme is concerned about the need to improve the information available to patients as they're making decisions about major surgery.
Layla spoke about her work on patient decision aids for NHS England and the Royal College of Anaesthetists, covering subjects such as knee arthritis or options for analgesia in labour.
I've usually asked enough clinicians, what do you need or want to tell them? And I've usually put it all in the same document because, you know, sometimes the risks that I include in a document aren't necessarily actually risky. Will an epidural give me backache? Well, no, it won't. The evidence is there that it doesn't. And as a norm, you wouldn't normally put a risk in a decision aid that isn't actually a risk, right? But I put it in the maternity decision aids about epidural because it's what women are worried about. It's what they ask about. So you include what people want to know and you include what clinicians want to tell them. What do they need to know? And I think it's worth doing because whatever you're doing, you're probably doing a bit of it. And you're probably doing a bit of it really well, but there's always going to be something that you can learn to do it a little bit better. And it makes things faster and easier. And your patients understand what's going on. If you tell somebody to go and do something and you don't tell them why they need to do it, nobody's going to go and do that, are they? If you show them that, look here, X number of people's knee replacement didn't actually need to happen if they did these exercises over, 2 months, they didn't actually need a knee replacement, you might be going, oh. Maybe I'll have a think of doing that.
Decision making and consent are entwined with risk and uncertainty. We asked Layla about how we could address uncertainty in the risks that we discuss with patients and their families.
So uncertainty and communicating uncertainty, see, I got excited about it. It was a big part of the Winton Centre work. And it's a big part of what we do in the decision aids and a big part of what I've trialed with all of the 500, 600, 700 patients. I've asked them in one-on-one interviews about these kind of things. So I can hear what people are saying. So yes, the uncertainty of the data and the uncertainty around ranges of the data, and I have to say, we can get a little bit caught up on, is it 0.1%? Is it 0.3%? Is it, and we had big arguments with our prostate guys. They were arguing, I think at one point we were arguing about 0.5%. Yes, you want to get it right. And yes, it's important to you guys. And certainly for, outcomes, surgical outcomes, these kind of are important. But to patients, you're always telling me what happened in the past. Here's what happened to people in the past. Here's what happened to people a little bit like you in the past. And people, normal people, understand that you're not predicting the future. And so we say, and when the decision aid is very, very clear, these numbers are what happened to people in the past, either in actual data, so either NHS audit data, or from research. And you always have a caveat in there that, these numbers might be higher or lower for you because there are certain things about you that we can't take into account. And we are all individuals, just like the Monty Python says, we're all individuals. I'm not. So people understand that the numbers are a guesstimate, so number one. So trying to be too precise is a fool's errand. And we always or often include ranges on our data. So we show bars usually when we're presenting risk outcomes, when we're presenting risks or benefits, because for two reasons, or a number of reasons, but two main reasons, you can compare them easily. So you can have, you know, on a piece of paper, it's quite easy to see different colors and different lengths of bars. That's lovely. So it's quite easily compared, but also you can quite easily show a range on a bar. So we use a little slope situation. If there's, you know, 5 to 20 people in research felt this, people get that the data is a little bit woolly. People just really want an idea. Is it a lot or is it a little? And you can't say a lot or a little with words because that's different to everybody. So if you just look at it and you give them these ranges. Now, what I found, interestingly, was that if I didn't give a range, often people... So we usually round up to the nearest 5 or 10, if we're talking out of 100, or we give a range. And I found that if we didn't do that, let's say I said, you know, 13 out of every 100 people, you know, felt this. People were less trusting of the number than if we rounded it up or down. They didn't really believe it. They were more, really? 13, but can you really say that? Whereas if you say about 15 or about 10 or 15 to 20, people believed the numbers more. People believed what you were saying more.
Leila also shared some golden rules for communicating risk.
So we have to be kind of clinical, non-persuasive, very clear in what we're communicating when we communicate risk. So we always say don't communicate with words, because what's a lot or a little to me or you? What's a high risk or a low risk to me or you? And it depends on the risk, 10% of dying versus 10% of having a headache, very different. So we don't use words because people misinterpret them. They're different for everyone. We don't use percentages because, as I said earlier, people don't understand how many a percentage is out of. We are an X factor generation. I'll give it 110%. We don't know that percentages are just 100. People don't know that. So we use natural frequencies. And we usually, if you can, use the same denominator so that you're not getting mix and match situations. The BAUS have done some really nice prostate information leaflets with risk, but they've used different denominators. And even I, when I was trying to convert them all into the same denominator, was getting very mathematically confused in my head. So the same denominator, X out of 100 if you can, or you whittle it up to out of 1,000 or out of 10,000. So you've always got the same denominator, especially if you're comparing things. We always use absolute risk and not just relative risk, right? So this is a big one. And it's a big one because absolute risk isn't always listed.
The conversation in perioperative medicine has highlighted the importance of identifying high-risk patients in order to tailor treatment decisions and adapt clinical pathways to reduce poor outcomes. Similarly, shared decision-making in high-risk patients is an area of focus, illustrated by Gemma and the OSIRIS team's work. However, all of our guests expressed caution regarding suggesting at a conceptual level that shared decision-making might be more important for certain groups of patients. But they did agree that for high-risk patients, shared decision-making is fundamentally important.
You know, if there is a risk, whether it's higher for you or lower for you, minuscule, you know, if you're telling me there's a risk, there's a risk. So I should know about that just as much as that high-risk person. So I believe that everybody should be, you know, explained to, as it were, equally. There's no, you're more important than me. In terms of regret, I mean, look, I've spoken to people who have said they wish they hadn't had the operation that they'd had, or that it didn't make much difference, or if they'd known X, Y, and Z, they wouldn't have done it. So I have spoken to people who have felt that. In the context, though, without blowing my own trumpet, of them saying, but if I'd had this beforehand, I maybe wouldn't have made that same decision. If I'd known this was a risk beforehand, I'm thinking of one particular one about cataracts. He, you know, it kind of didn't work for him. He didn't have a clue that it wasn't going to ever work. And, you know, you can see in the numbers, oh, I didn't know that. And had I known that, I might not have, he said, because I didn't think it was that bad. And, you know, so there's all that. And where women shared decision-making does come in, it's about understanding what's going on, understanding what might happen, understanding what might happen if I don't do anything. The do-nothing option is, you know, should be front and, you know, with flashing lights. You can always not do anything. And this is what might happen if you don't do anything. So, people may regret the decision they made, but they're going to regret it less if they knew what might happen in the first place, aren't they? And everybody, you know, whether you're high risk or low risk, the risks may be different. Your propensity to have that risk may be different. But you and the person who's, you know, young, fit and healthy should still know about it the same, right?
Clearly shared decision-making is for everyone and for every decision. But certainly when the stakes are higher, we need to put more effort into making sure that the information is understood and that we understand the patient. And there's some really good case studies and work that's gone on in things like elective AAA repair, where there's very high risks, or high risk arthroplasty, so people who are high operative risk. And the thing is there that the risks need to be really personalized. So the surgeon may be able to give good stats based on populations on the outcomes of their arthroplasties. But when it comes to that person's risk on the table, risk of perioperative complications, postoperative complications, they're going to be very personal and individual to that person. And so those conversations, they take, I think, a lot more skill and knowledge. And because the risks are much higher, I think they are by necessity higher stakes and more important to get right. The most important aspect of it is that patients should always feel that they can make whatever decision they feel is right for them, including doing nothing. And what we tend to see with these case studies, particularly in high-risk patients, again and again and again, is that if we really do talk to them about the risks and benefits, ask them to weigh them up, encourage them to think about what's important to them, they will often choose not to have the intervention. Those that will go into the process thinking they will have the intervention are quite consistently changing their mind. You don't get more people wanting the intervention than less. And that tells us, and there's also some great studies about what clinicians would choose for themselves compared to what they would choose for their patients. And there's often a mismatch. And so the decisions that we make about what might be best for the patient is often different from what patients make for what's best for them. And I think we'll all agree there's only one person whose opinion is important in that situation. There's another group, interestingly, that really benefit from shared decision making according to the literature, and that's people who have low health literacy. So health literacy is a really important contributor to health inequalities. And people who find understanding health information more difficult, feel less empowered to participate in consultations, perhaps don't feel able or are unable to get their own information about procedures and options. And so by ensuring that they have a proper shared decision-making conversation prior to any procedure, they don't have to do that work. It's done for them. And so those people are more likely to benefit from shared decision making, and it levels the playing field to some extent and helps reduce that particular health inequality. And I think that's obviously a laudable aim in all of our healthcare encounters. there are a couple of things when it comes to research and decision making. Is one, it's really difficult because measuring shared decision making is very tricky, and I won't bore you with why that is. But also, we shouldn't measure the outcomes based on the decision made. So you shouldn't look at decision regret for people who didn't have the surgery. You should look at decision regret for all the people who made that decision, people who went on to have the surgery and the people who didn't go on to have the surgery. And time again, when you look at the use of decision support tools and interventions that aim to increase shared decision-making, what you see is reduced decision regret. And it's quite, I think, quite a good measure of whether we're achieving what we're trying to achieve in these situations. But what you can't do is judge a decision-making process by outcomes, particularly, you know, things like pain or quality of life or death, because it's a bit difficult to unpick all that. But would people make the same decision again? You know, that decision regret element of it, I think, is a really good way of looking at it. Requirement in order for this process to work well is the clinician must be decision agnostic. They must go into that consultation not caring, in inverted commas, because obviously we care, but not caring what decision that patient makes, just so long as they are confident that the process they've gone through allows them to say that person has made the right decision for them. And they can say, I think that this is the right decision for you, but you can make a different decision if you want. And that's okay. And that will help with their conscience and their ego and their hubris and all the hard work the MDT's put in. But they have to be humble enough to allow a person to make the right decision for them, even if they don't think that it's the right decision from their perspective or the same decision they would make for themselves. But doing that is very difficult, and it requires a really high degree, I think, of self-reflection and insight into how we consult that is often lacking. And I do think that egos and hubris are other really important words, as well as, you know, biases and heuristics, because these are human emotions that we have as clinicians that, unless we acknowledge them, they will override this process. And I have a slight problem with MDTs coming up with one answer rather than options and risks and benefits. Because that's what the outcome of an MDT should not be. This is the recommended. This is what should happen. An MDT should say, right, we now have essentially a bespoke decision support tool for this person. These are the options. These are what we think the risks and the benefits are. Someone needs to now go away and chat with that, with the patient, and then we can have the answer. Or even better, the patient is involved in the MDT and they can do it all together. But that, I think, isn't a reality in a lot of settings. But I know that there are some MDTs that do incorporate patients and have the patient voice there at the discussion, which I think is possibly something that people should think about incorporating.
So shared decision making is expected to be available to everybody. It's seen as the model of good person-centered care. And I think what our research has found is that actually it's more or less difficult to do shared decision making in certain situations. So although I would say yes, I think for high risk patients, shared decision making is perhaps, well, it's about, I wouldn't want to say it's more important for them than other groups of patients. It is very important because of the greater likelihood of complications post-surgery, but it can also, that their situation can also make that process more difficult. So the situation where somebody is contemplating surgery that they regard as life-saving makes it very hard to think about the next stage in treatment as being something they have a decision to make or a choice to make, because it becomes then, well, it's life or death. So to what extent actually might it feel like there is a decision to be made, let alone a shared decision? Most people, I mean, I don't know the literature very well on this, but most people, after they've had an encounter with a healthcare professional generally find it quite positive and will say positive things about it. Whether they would say the same, whether they'd got different treatment, it's really hard to judge, isn't it? And that's another problem with measuring the quality, I think, of decision-making consultations. Yeah, but a sort of, we looked for this idea of decision regret as well. We wanted to see whether people might regret the decisions they'd made. It didn't come up. We were slightly curtailed in our follow-ups because of the pandemic, so we weren't able to do quite as much follow-up as we wanted. But patients didn't talk about regret. They tended to almost justify or kind of rationalise about the decisions they had made. There was one patient who had found having surgery and the recovery from surgery much more difficult than he'd expected, was actually, I would suggest, quite traumatised by the surgery and the recovery. He had open heart surgery. But still did not express decision regret. He was still coming to terms with the decision he'd made and the treatment he'd had, rather than saying, oh, I wish I hadn't made that decision. So that's quite an interesting non-finding, if you like.
Sam talked about the evidence supporting reduced healthcare utilisation when shared decision making is delivered effectively. But this should never be used as motivation or to manipulate conversations. Scotland's Realistic Medicine Programme highlights this concept eloquently, seeking to better align the goals of patients with the healthcare interventions available. NHS England has challenged services to shift preoperative screening and risk assessment upstream in perioperative pathways, but Gemma again highlighted the challenge of timing.
I think there's a potential that patients might misperceive the motivations behind shared decision-making if it's done badly. But only if it's done badly. I think if you have a good conversation with someone where you're really trying to understand what's important to them and make sure they have make the right decision for them, then people will feel listened to, cared about, understood, and appreciate the fact that someone's taking the time to make sure that they are making the right decision for them. I work in the community. Not infrequently speak to patients who have been to see a specialist, have been recommended to have a procedure, and they come to see me and they say, I have no idea what I've signed up for. I don't know what's going on. And they're completely oblivious, and they're worried that they're going to be swept along in a system where they end up with a procedure that they haven't understood. And I think patients really, they will, first of all, they shouldn't end up in that position. But if they do end up in that position, what I say to them is you can say stop to this. You can put a pause on this and say, I want to have a chat about my options because I don't fully understand what they are. And I didn't realize I could ask questions, or I didn't realize I could say no, or I didn't realize I could say, what are the alternatives here? What's nice about shared decision-making personalized care from a system point of view is that it tends to result in fewer people having procedures. It tends to result in less medicalization because that's what people often want. And so it tends to ease system pressures if it's done well. But it should never be used to manipulate people's decisions. And it shouldn't be used to the ends of reducing pressures on an overwhelmed system, even if it does. We should be doing shared decision making because it's the right thing for people. It's actually the right thing for clinicians as well. It feels so much better doing this. It makes you feel like you're doing a good job, and you're connecting with people. And I don't think I've come across people who have complained that they've had shared decision making conversations.
What I am interested in doing, and this is a kind of the next step in the research we're doing, is seeing if we can look at how we organise decision-making consultations differently. So we're going to do a piece of work where we consider in particular the role of anaesthetists in shared decision-making and looking at the kind of sequencing of the events. So this came partly out of our qualitative work and our observations of those consultations, but we also did some focus groups with anaesthetists and other clinicians. And, you know, the typical problem was that a patient would have their referral, they'd see the surgeon, there'd be a discussion about whether or not to have surgery, and then they'd have their kind of high-risk pre-op assessment. At that point, the anaesthetist might be quite concerned. But by that point, it's a little bit late to have the discussion. The patient feels that the decision's already been made. So we're interested in seeing whether we might offer some alternative ways of running that sequence so that there is a discussion earlier with the patient about not just preparing for surgery or having surgery delayed, but actually having the decision about surgery to involve a wider range of clinicians, particularly anaesthetists, but also potentially other clinicians and indeed other people at an earlier stage.
We asked our speakers to imagine that they or someone they loved was in the position of a patient and what they might want to take away from a shared decision-making conversation.
But if you've asked me if I was going to design it myself, like blue sky thinking, then I would argue that one of my residents was making a high-risk surgical decision, I would want someone who has no flesh in the game helping me make the decision. I wouldn't want the surgeon helping me make the decision because they care about the aggregate surgical outcomes of their surgery. They might worry about the, taking a risk that they wouldn't take for themselves for a patient. They might worry about complaints. They might worry about relatives saying you shouldn't have operated on my mum. And likewise, I'm not an anaesthetist, I know an anaesthetist, but I imagine having a death on the table is an absolute disaster and it causes an awful lot of problems. And so operating on someone that you think is at high risk of intraoperative or post-operative death would be, or adversary, would be really influential in your recommendations to someone. So what I would want is someone who understands the medical information, is skilled in communicating risks, is empathetic, able to listen, and has the time to discuss it, but really is decision agnostic in the most pure way so that they aren't influencing the decision. And you could have that. You could have people whose job it is to help people make decisions. And I think some good MDTs do that. I think they do, and they're often nurses, and because you do need a lot of specialist knowledge still, skill, but you're not necessarily the people doing the procedures. I think it would solve a few of the problems that we know about people's undue influences on the decision making if we remove those biases from the conversation.
I think it's also really hard to put yourself in the shoes of actually going through that process yourself. And you think, this is what I would want, this is what I would think, this is how I'd react. But it does change the matter when you are actually in that situation. What I have observed and what I felt was really productive was somebody who was really prepared to listen and to explore alternative options and come up with, if you like, a bit of a workaround and not just follow, okay, this is the procedure we do. We always do this procedure with this particular condition, but actually say, well, okay, so maybe you need a slightly shorter operation. So what could we do? And that takes a great deal of experience and skill as well. And yeah, talking through the options, offering time to return and come back and discuss things. Those are things that sound easy to offer, but as we were saying earlier, in a very busy clinical environment, sometimes it's not possible to do that.
I'd like to know that the person having surgery is aware that they have options, number one, and what those options are. And I want them to feel that they've been listened to, that they've been given the opportunity to talk about their worries, their concerns, their values, their preferences, and feel that they've been listened to, and that's been incorporated into the decision-making process. And unfortunately, a lot of people, I feel, do feel like that. They feel that no matter what they said in that consultation, the consultation will have ended in exactly the same way. I do think that it requires a lot of effort and some change in terms of our processes, but primarily a change in terms of our attitudes and our culture, which are difficult to change, but not impossible, and we'll keep working on it.
Thank you to our speakers, Sam, Lila and Gemma, and to my co-host, Stuart. For further resources, please see the information and links in the description, where you'll find information on some of the resources discussed in the podcast. Be sure to follow or subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review. Thanks again for listening.